is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Cincinnati's mayor and city manager unveiled a new budget proposal today. Cradle Cincinnati announced new infant mortality data earlier this week. Some state lawmakers want new social studies standards for Ohio students, and opponents of an effort to make it harder to amend Ohio's constitution filed a new lawsuit challenging Issue 1. There's been a lot of news to keep up with this week, and we're going to talk with reporters who can help us break it all down, starting with what's happening in Columbus. Joining me now are Ohio Public Radio Television and State House... Yes, Ohio Public Radio and Television State House News Bureau reporter, you know who you are, and producer Joe Ingles. Welcome back, Joe.
It's a Friday. It's great to be here.
It is a Friday. It feels real Friday. And USA Today Network Ohio Bureau reporter Anna Staver. Thanks for being here, Anna.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Well, Joe, as I mentioned, there's this new lawsuit related to Issue 1. What's the complaint behind this lawsuit filed against the Ohio Ballot Board?
Yeah, this new lawsuit basically is a complaint against the language itself that voters are going to see when they go to vote on this. The group that brought the complaint, one person or one vote, it's a group, it's a coalition of unions, Democrats, different people. And they are asking the Ohio Supreme Court to force the ballot board to go back and rewrite the language. The complaint is that there isn't enough context and that it doesn't currently state what the current law is on constitutional amendments. And they say, well, the voters should be able to walk into the voting booth and read the language, understand what it is, what it does, what the change is. And without that, it lacks the proper context.
Well, and help us understand what Issue 1 would do if approved. We've talked about this on the program before, but for anybody who's missed it or needs a little bit of a refresher.
Sure. It would raise the threshold for voting in a constitutional amendment. It would raise that threshold from 50% plus one, which it is now, to 60%. But not only that, this could be even more complicated here. Right now, if you go to put something on the ballot, you have to go to 44 counties and get a certain percentage from those 44 counties as signatures on petitions. If this passes, you would have to go to all 88 counties, which is a much heavier lift. And the other thing is that right now, when you go to get your signatures and turn them in, there's what's called a cure period, where you can go back out, you can get more signatures to correct any flaws and any petition signatures that are there. That would go away. So it would make it much harder to pass constitutional issues in the future. And, you know, we've seen some of our former governors, some of our former AGs on both sides of the aisle have weighed in saying, you know, it would also make it hard to pass economic benefit programs like, you know, Third Frontier or something that we've passed in the past that's been great for the economy. Well, I guess arguably great for the economy. Some people don't think so. But, you know, it's been a big economic package that they really needed to get through. And those kind of things would be harder to do.
Well, and you mentioned that this group, One Person, One Vote, is really arguing against the ballot language. Tell us a little bit more about the specifics this group is arguing against. What do they think? What are the things they think are so unclear about this language?
Well, not having the context, that's a huge thing, because if you read this, the word elevate is used to elevate something, and it kind of gives an air of, oh, you're going to make it, you know, you're going to make it harder, but it's going to be better. You know, it's got that better thing going. Because it doesn't tell how hard it currently is to put something on the ballot, this group believes that it basically is leading people to believe there really aren't safeguards, that it's easy to throw something on the ballot right now, that something can get passed quickly and easily. And we all know, those of us who cover these constitutional issues, that that's not the case. There have been many things that cannot get on the ballot because they can't get the signatures for it and they don't have the ability for it.
Right. And it doesn't state clearly, hey, there's already a way to vote to amend the Constitution. We're
right.
Just changing the threshold. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. It doesn't state that.
Yeah. So how has Ohio Secretary of State Frank LaRose defended this language?
Well, basically, he says you don't need all that language on there. You know, it's just a confusing thing for voters when they see a lot of language, and that, you know, they're going to have time to look at, you know, other information about this before they go to the polls. And, you know, we need to keep it clear, as few words as possible, that kind of thing. He doesn't see the need to do this.
This is the second lawsuit related to issue one. Tell us what the first one's about.
Yeah, the first one was filed, and that was about the August election because they want to have an August 8 election. But here's the thing. Ohio lawmakers at the end of last year passed this bill with a big to-do about how the August elections were expensive, how no one turned out for them, how they were really not a good way to pass anything. And so they made this bill, they pass it, get rid of August elections in most cases. The governor signs it, and before the ink is even dry and that's in place, then we've got a bill in the legislature on August elections. Well, some of the lawmakers who voted for that in the past said, hey, we are not going to vote in a bill, you know, to have an August election after we just voted it out. And they thought it looked kind of hypocritical, so they wouldn't do it. So they attached some of the language that could allow this August election. They attached that in with the amendment. And that's where, you know, there's a complaint that that's not right, that that's not the proper way to do it, that you have to go through the proper channel of actually going in and doing the bill and setting the August election.
Well, and there's a strong reason why these supporters of issue one want this on the ballot in August.
Exactly.
Yeah, to explain that for us.
Well, we all know, if you've been anywhere, you've probably seen people out with petitions trying to get signatures for a constitutional amendment that would enshrine abortion rights in Ohio's constitution. That is expected to be on the November ballot. And they the people who are behind that are out getting signatures right now. They have until the first week of July to come in with those. It is expected that they will have the signatures, you know, or be close to it because they've been working very hard and they've got a well-oiled machine, a lot of people behind that whole effort. So the lawmakers who don't want abortion rights are really against having, you know, that opportunity. And so this would just make it harder because even though the parts about the petition wouldn't apply to the abortion amendment because they've already started that petition process, the 60% would apply. And if you look at, you know, other states, if you look at polling in Ohio, it is very likely that the if it were to pass, it would come in over 50%, but under 60. So there's a strategy there. And that's what makes it important to get something done and in place. That's why they want it before the August or before the November election. If they get it in August, it would be in place by November and that 60% threshold would apply.
Interesting. So am I correct that both of these lawsuits are going before the Ohio Supreme Court?
Yes, they are both in front of the Ohio Supreme Court. And as you know, we have a new court because it's more Republican dominated. Maureen O'Connor, who was Republican, but kind of independent thinking in a lot of ways, she's no longer there. So we've got a more solid Republican court. A lot of people are watching it to see, you know, what the response will be. I guess the court cannot respond, but, you know, there's a thinking that there will be some response at some point. So that's where we are right now. We're kind of in a waiting pattern, just wanting to see what happens here.
And what are the chances of these lawsuits, considering the much more Republican-dominated Supreme Court we have now?
Well, you know, we do know that the new justices on the Supreme Court, in most of the cases, they have already gone on record saying that they oppose abortion. And they had the backing of Ohio Right to Life when they were running for office. So we know where they stand on the theology of that, you know, on that issue. What we don't know is how are they, you know, how will that play into their thinking as to what they do with this? Are they going to apply this on pure constitutional, you know, standards, or are they going to, you know, be more activist and maybe let, you know, personal things get in. I don't know. It's a good question. We don't know where it'll go from here.
Interesting. Well, I want to move on to another, some more news that's lawsuit related. And you both did some reporting on this. Anna, there was this, you had a story this week about this request for data from the state auditor that was sent to public school districts. But we should first explain the lawsuit involving those districts that kind of triggered this request for data. Can you walk us through that?
Yeah. So about 2 years ago, 100 school districts sued the state, and they're challenging the school voucher law. This is known as like the EdChoice scholarships. And what they allege is that Ohio's constitution guarantees a funding of a common system of schools. And they say common means singular, and that the voucher program has grown to such a size that it's now two systems of schools, and that's not constitutional. That's like the thrust of their argument. And, you know, because court battles can take years, in the last couple of months, they've just started the subpoena process. They're trying to depose key players. So back in March, they notified Senate President Matt Huffman that they were going to subpoena him. The attorneys are arguing over whether that's going to happen, which is totally normal. But a couple weeks ago, the Senate president turned to his chief legal counsel and said, hey, as we're putting the budget together and doing this stuff, I want to know how much school districts are spending on lawsuits challenging state laws. And so his legal counsel reached out to the auditor's office. The auditor's office decided to send out this survey. And then those districts that are suing said, hey, this feels a little inappropriate given that we are currently in the process of trying to depose the guy who asked for this information.
Joe, what has the Senate president said about that reaction from school district, you know, spokespeople and attorneys?
So I spoke with him this week and he said it's baseless. He said that this is a public record, which is true. Like, you know, school boards vote to allocate their money in public ways. And so he would like an accounting of this. He said he's also looking at other data points like their carryover balances, which is kind of like how much money, you know, school districts have in their savings accounts. And a bunch of other stuff as he's like figuring out things like the school funding formula or whether there's going to be policy changes in the future. He says, like, this is just me doing my job. This is not related to the lawsuit, but obviously the schools don't take it that way.
And Joe, do we know how this information could be used if it gets collected?
Well, if it gets collected, it could be used against, you know, at least the groups who are behind this lawsuit say it could be used against the schools. And, let's not forget, we're in the middle of a budget. The lawmakers are deciding how the money's going to be spent in the next couple of years. And the groups behind this are saying there could be some punitive kind of actions taken against schools. And they're just nervous about it.
Anna, what more are you hearing from districts? What is their big fear of what could be done with this information?
That basically what Joe said, that they could be penalized in some way. Or that it could maybe dissuade other districts from joining on to the lawsuit. And, you know, we'll just kind of have to see how that all plays out. But the bigger, more immediate question is that the Vouchers Hurt Ohio, that's the coalition of schools, sent a really strongly worded letter to the state attorney general's office. So the AG is who defends the state in cases like this. And it said, if the auditor doesn't rescind the survey and apologize, they're going to go to the judge and try to have the state held in contempt.
Wow. Well, and I want to talk to you about another story, and that relates to state property tax increases. What's going on with property values and property taxes in Ohio right now?
Oh, gosh. This is I will try to keep this as simple as possible when it comes to property taxes. But essentially, the good news is that home values, real estate values across the state are rising. And they're rising at pretty historic levels. So if you own a home, it's worth a lot more than it was a couple years ago. The downside to that is when your home value goes up, so does your property taxes, right? Because they're a percentage of your home's value. And there is a schedule at which your state your county assessor, I'm sorry, goes around and reappraises, right? They're not constantly updating values. They do it every, they do an update every 3 years and then a full reappraisal every 6 years. And that update for folks in Butler County, down by you guys, is looking like a 42% increase in property values. Now, it's not exact and uniform across the county, and that's not a one-to-one increase in your property taxes. But for some folks, the county auditor down in Butler County said, this is going to be a dramatic spike next January.
Well, I would imagine, especially for homeowners who are on a fixed income.
Yeah, that seems to be the biggest concern. And, you know, how much you pay extra depends. It's a very complicated system, but it depends on what school district you're in, what kind of levies they've passed, when those levies were passed, what other state laws like bind those or don't bind those. But, you know, so your property taxes could be very different from like the property taxes of somebody a couple blocks over. So it's really hard to say, like, you know, a 42% value increase equals X. But they assume it's going to be really, really substantial. So there's a bunch of lawmakers that are concerned about this, particularly for those people on fixed incomes. And what they want to do is kind of change how those new rates get set. So generally, best practice right now is to look at the last year of home sales. And the last year of home sales in Butler County would mean a 42% increase over the last time there was an appraisal. But if you merged those 3 years, right, instead of just going with the last year, but the 3 years over time, it would bring that down to about 25%. So what lawmakers are considering is requiring the Department of Taxation to look at 3 years worth of data instead of one. And that sort of softens the blow of that increase.
Joe, how hard will it be for lawmakers to really address this problem? It seems like a pretty complicated situation.
Well, it is kind of complicated, honestly. And if you look at how they're doing it, they're doing a lot of this. They're doing a lot of moving of different things. It's not just this one bill, but they're looking in the budget. They want to, you know, make flatter taxes. So that's got an effect on property values indirectly. They're also looking at some, you know, changes that would basically make it so that they could tie the property tax valuation with inflation, because inflation has paid a big price here. And then there are some things that they're talking about behind the scenes that they haven't introduced a bill yet, but those would be like price controls, basically, for, you know, keeping your taxes down so that if you make a certain amount of money, there would be like a limit, something like that. So that's something that has been bandied about but not come out in legislation yet. But there are many different ways that they're looking at this. It's not just one bill. And the problem, of course, is when you move one thing, then something else happens. You know, it's a big, you know. So that's what they're dealing with, is trying to strike balance here. But I think there is a will among the lawmakers to do something about this, because they're hearing from Ohioans who are upset and cannot stay in their home because they can't afford it.
Mm. Well, I want to try to talk about one more story just briefly that you reported, Anna, this week, and that relates to social studies standards. As I understand from your reporting, there's a bill that's been introduced that would result in new academic standards for history classes in Ohio. What would that bill do?
Yeah, so there's a Republican lawmaker named Don Jones, and he says he's worried that Ohio kids aren't learning the basics in social studies, right? And so he said he wants to create a new, far more specific set of state standards. You know, he wants to base it off this plan called American Birthright, and it's like 120 pages long, so it's a lot of very detailed facts that kids would need to know before they graduate. The issue that social studies teachers and Democrats have with this idea is, well, there's a couple, but the biggest is that American Birthright leans heavily on former President Donald Trump's 1776 project. It makes very broad statements about like DEI and like CRT and in opposition. And they think this is a very narrow conservative set of standards to put on kids. There's a concern that it might be a whitewashing of history. So there's a lot of debate about A, whether our current standards aren't good, and B, if we should look at our social studies standards or try to improve them, like how we go about that.
And why do these state standards matter so much?
Oh, because so state standards are what we use to create the state exams, right? So teachers are obviously going to teach to the exams because those are requirements for graduation and for moving up grade levels. They can also have an impact on model curricula, and which the State Board of Education currently creates. And that model curricula is really helpful, especially to young teachers who are starting out. It kind of gives them a roadmap. And then it also, you know, state standards, particularly in large states, so Texas is much more influential than we are, but statewide standards influence what go in textbooks, right? Like, so if you need a textbook that has all of your state standards, you know, manufacturers listen to that. They start to build materials that suit your standards so they can sell those books.
Gotcha. Well, I know you'll be following this very closely. Is there any feel for how much support there is for this right now, for this bill that's been introduced?
It seems like there's a decent amount of support in House Republicans. I haven't really pinged the folks in the Senate yet, but, you know, it is a Republican supermajority at the legislature. So, you know, all they need is to get most of their members on board.
Is this kind of part of a trend when you consider, you know, what lawmakers are trying to do with Senate Bill 83 also?
Yeah, I think, you know, this big debate over what's being taught in school, whether what it, you know, kids are learning is appropriate, whether they're being like inculcated with ideology. We've heard that bubbling up a lot in the last couple of years, both at the K-12 level and now at the college level. So this definitely seems like it's the next iteration of that. And, you know, because we haven't passed those like blanket sort of sweeping educational reforms, this is a more narrowly tailored bite at the apple, if that makes sense.
Well, I know you will be continuing to follow that. Thank you so much for your time today. I've been talking with Ohio Public Radio and Television State House News Bureau reporter and producer Joe Ingles and USA Today Network Ohio Bureau reporter Anna Staver. Thank you both so much for your time today. I hope you get some R&R this weekend.
Thanks for having me. You too.
Thanks. Up next, Cincinnati's mayor and city manager unveiled a new budget proposal today. We'll hear what's in it. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Earlier today, Cincinnati Mayor Aftab Purval and City Manager Cheryl Long unveiled a new city budget proposal. Joining me now to explain what's in it and talk about why it's important is WVXU local government reporter Becca Costello. Welcome back, Becca.
Happy to be here, Lucy.
Glad to have you. I know you've just raced over from City Hall. You did have a story up on our website just the minute you could that said, with your main headline was, the proposed budget has an increase for public safety. Tell us about that first.
Yeah, and it's not really a surprise. That was the top of the list for council's budget priorities when they let the administration know what they wanted to see in the budget. So when we say public safety, we're primarily talking about the police department and the fire department. Both of those had an increase this year, have a recommended increase for this year. Excuse me. And I just need to scroll down to the right place in the story. There we go. Okay. The police department is projected to have a 6.7% increase, and then the fire department a 2.5% increase. That is pretty standard. You know, it's not a significant increase for those departments. However, it's notable because the general fund, which includes the police and fire departments and others, the overall general fund is actually decreasing a bit this year. The primary reason for that is the city used a lot more federal stimulus last year. They're using less of that this year, and so that's why there's a decrease in the general fund.
And what are the implications of that, the fact that there's less revenue available for the general fund?
This year, there is still not a deficit. The city is covering the deficit. However, they actually had to pull a little bit of what was planned to cover next fiscal year's deficit to cover this year's deficit. And it all goes back to the earnings tax, which is, you know, I'm sure we've talked about many times on this program. But basically, it's the city relies heavily on the earnings tax. We're getting a lot less of that. That has a lot to do with people working from home, because if they don't live in the city and they're working from home outside the city, they don't owe that tax anymore and they can ask for a refund. So for this year, there's no budget cuts, but they are predicting about a little over 1% cut across all departments next year unless something changes. And that's even with what's left of the federal stimulus covering most of next year's budget deficit. They're saying there probably won't be enough to cover the full deficit.
Okay, so maybe this gets too far ahead, but, you know, you said they have federal money to fill the deficit this year. They've got some that'll help with next year. Well, what does the future hold with this? I mean, this federal money is not going to be around forever to fill this deficit with this problem with the earnings tax.
Yeah, and there's a lot of unknown. So I will say the city typically budgets conservatively, which means they're intentionally underestimating how much revenue they think will come in. This happened last year. They underestimated, and the revenue was quite a bit higher than they predicted, and that's why there was kind of a record high carryover budget late last year that folks might remember. That is definitely possible next year. They're predicting a budget deficit, but things could change. Revenue might go up, and then there's not actually a budget deficit to fill. But as you mentioned, the stimulus won't last forever. Next year is the end of the line for stimulus. It'll be about $25 million left. All that it can be used for next year is to fill as much of the deficit as possible. And then they're predicting there will still be a gap. That means the year after next year, so looking at fiscal year 2026, and that would start in calendar year 2025, there's going to be likely a pretty big deficit without any federal stimulus to fill it. And so what that means is budget cuts. And or trying to find ways to increase revenue. Now, one way the city is trying to do that is by selling the railroad, which is a whole other controversial issue that we don't have time to talk about. But the point being that the city is looking at other ways to increase the revenue. One other thing is the Futures Commission, which is kind of the new version of what a lot of people know of as the SMAIL Commission. And that is being led by the private business community. And the idea is to look at the entire city budget, projected revenues, expenditures, et cetera, and figure out what does the city need to do differently. One option on the table is an increase to the earnings tax. Now, none of that has been decided. That's very early in the process, but that's another way the city is looking to the long-term budgeting.
Well, and do I understand correctly that the mayor had a separate budget plan that he unveiled today, too? What's that about, and how does that differ from the city manager's?
Yeah, it's a little bit of an interesting way they did this. So basically, the way the main budget process works is it starts with the city manager's office. The city manager then transmits it to the mayor, who has the option to make any changes before it goes to council. Council has final say. They can make changes, and they get the final say. What typically happens, at least in recent history, is that the mayor and the city manager really work very closely together on this first draft, and that certainly happened here. What the mayor did, instead of making line item changes to the city manager's budget, was they basically found some extra money that's really not in the biennial budget. It comes from about $5 million that was kind of left over, I guess, from fiscal year 2023, which is the one that's about to end. So he's just kind of proposing reallocations for that. And then about $6 million from returned tax credits related to the railway board. That's complicated. I don't fully understand it yet. Yeah. I'm still learning what to say about that. So basically, it will be a separate ordinance, separate from that the main biennial budget. And he's proposed some spending for that, and includes some pilot programs he wants to do. Also, some like basically just additional funding for stuff that is in the budget, but just kind of giving that a boost. And that, I should say, though, council also has final say over. So even though it's a separate ordinance from the budget, council will have the opportunity to make changes or completely overhaul it, choose something entirely different for that money, and they will make that decision around the same time as the budget.
Well, and maybe this is too wonky and in the weeds, but did they explain why they had this separate ordinance outside of the budget? I mean, is it because of where the money's come from? Why did the mayor switch it up in terms of how this process works this year?
Technically, it's just because it is different funding sources, and that part makes sense. Now, practically speaking, it's a way for the mayor to add to the budget and kind of put his name on some things without taking away from funding that the city manager has proposed. And last year in the budget process, council did something similar where basically on a second look at the budget office said, hey, we kind of freed up a couple million dollars. What do you want to spend it on, council? And that's how they were able to add things to the budget without making any cuts. It may happen that way this year as well, but I think that's kind of part of it is really just like allowing the mayor to kind of take ownership of a couple of projects without having to take away money from other things.
I see. Okay. Well, and as you mentioned, this is the proposed budget. This is the first step in the budgeting process. Walk us through that process. What's next with all this?
So the very next thing will be on Tuesday, whatever date that is, the 30th, I think
that's right.
At the next budget and finance meeting, everything is shifted a week because of the holiday on Monday. The administration will present that budget to the budget and finance committee. That's your first chance for the public to give feedback now that they've seen the budget. And then a week later on Monday, June 5th in the evening, there'll be a public hearing. This will be the last, you know, outside of council meetings, public hearing. Usually all the public hearings happen after this budget, after this step in the process. This year, they kind of front loaded the schedule with that public input first. So now there's only one public hearing left. And then you can also give public comment during the regular council and budget and finance meetings. They have a hard deadline of June 30th, but typically council tries to pass the budget this the third week of June so that there's a little bit of wiggle room there. So I'm expecting a final passage the week of June 19th.
Okay. So people have a little bit of time to express their thoughts to council over the next few weeks.
And I hope they do.
Okay. That gives that. You'll be there to listen to what they have to say. I know.
That is true.
I've been talking with WVXU local government reporter extraordinaire Becca Costello. Thanks for your time today, Becca.
Thank you, Lucy.
Up next, hundreds of local seniors must move as several local nursing homes close. We'll talk about what's happening. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. The impending closure of several local nursing homes means hundreds of Greater Cincinnati seniors, some of our most vulnerable community members, must find new places to live. And a new report this week contained heartbreaking news about another of the region's most vulnerable populations, newborn babies. Hamilton County's infant mortality rate increased in 2022. Joining me now to discuss their reporting on these important stories are WCPO9 iTeam reporter Paula Christian. Welcome back, Paula.
Thanks, Lucy.
And WVXU senior editor and reporter Tana Weingartner. Thanks for being here, Tana.
So excited.
Yes. Paula, I want to start with you, and I want to talk about these nursing home closures, but first I want to talk briefly about an update you had recently on Cincinnati's deferred maintenance. We just talked about the city's proposed budget. There's going to be a lot of discussion about all of that ahead. You've been following this for years, this issue of deferred maintenance. What's the big picture as far as the city of Cincinnati's deferred maintenance and just how much work there is to be done?
Well, the city of Cincinnati is an old city, and it hasn't devoted enough money to maintain its old buildings, its fire stations, its police stations, its rec centers, health centers for a very long time. So now it's gotten to the point where it literally is facing $500 million problem of deferred maintenance at these old buildings. And this is everything from, you know, they need to replace air conditioning to many rec centers aren't ADA compliant. I mean, many of these city buildings aren't even up to code. So it's a big problem.
It's taken a long time to get to this point. What will it take to dig out of this hole?
A lot of money. I mean, the problem is that the budget is so, the margins of the city's capital budget are so small that, I mean, maybe, you know, they can devote, you know, for example, $3.5 million to 88 buildings, which I think is exactly what we're looking at for next year, which is just typical for all the city's fire stations, for City Hall, for the fleet garage, which I've highlighted in my reporting. I mean, $3.5 million. Like, what? I mean, and these are 100-year-old buildings in some cases. I mean, anybody who has an old house knows how difficult it is to keep up with the maintenance on that. So it's going to take years, or it's going to take an influx of cash like Becca was talking about. I mean, you know, it's probably going to take an increase in the city's earnings tax, and the city is probably going to have to close some of these buildings, consolidate, and sell off some of these buildings. It just can't afford to maintain all of them.
Well, and you talked about ADA compliance, which of course is vitally important. This is also potentially dangerous for city employees, isn't it?
There are so many aspects of these buildings that are dangerous to city employees that I would even think that the ADA compliance would be the least of the concerns. Mm. I mean, you know, there's old electrical, there's, you know, I've been in some of the city's oldest fire stations. I mean, there's a fire station in Madisonville that was literally built for horse and buggy. And it only has one bay that can fit one piece of city fire apparatus that's left. And once that engine stops working, the city will have no fire apparatus that can fit in this fire station. And this is right across from a, you know, Madisonville's getting all of this huge development, a lot of it funded through city TIFs and other incentives. And meanwhile, it has a fire station that's built, that's 100 years old, built for horse and buggy.
Yeah. Well, Paul, I know you're going to keep on top of that and keep covering it as you have been for years. I want to make sure we talk about this nursing home story that you reported this week too. I think you said three Cincinnati nursing homes are closing this month. What's going on? That seems like a lot all at once.
It is. It's really unprecedented. You know, I talked to the folks at Pro Seniors and they say it is just a function of the nursing home industry right now. You know, like everyone else, we're all paying more for groceries, for food, for gas, for just basic necessities. So while the cost of caring for the elderly is going up, the nursing home operators are saying that their Medicaid reimbursement rate from the state is staying the same. So, you know, they are having a lot of difficulty with that. And then the other big problem is staffing. I mean, it's a tight labor market. Working at a nursing home is not an easy job, and they are having to raise pay. And again, you know, that's, they say that's not covered by the Medicaid reimbursement. So they're just struggling. And a lot of these nursing homes are owned by large companies. So they're consolidating. You know, it's like any business that's, you know, has to consolidate to save money. But unfortunately, you know, that means closing down nursing homes and moving residents to other nursing homes. And it's very difficult for these poor residents who are confused and anxious and might have not entirely great. They might not be completely aware of their surroundings or have, you know, full faculties. So that makes it even harder.
How many residents are being affected by all this?
It's roughly 200 residents. They did expect by today that they would all be moved into their new homes. But, you know, the move was not smooth. There was a lot of drama involved in moving these seniors because, you know, everybody in the industry is facing the same economic challenges. So everybody's interested in claiming these displaced residents and trying to move them into their nursing home. And it was just hard for them.
Did you, I believe you reported there was kind of some high pressure tactics happening, weren't there?
Yes. Pro Seniors described some very overly aggressive admissions directors at nursing homes that kind of would descend on these facilities that are closing and try and get residents to come to their facilities. You know, and on the flip side, you have the nursing homes themselves who want to keep these residents within their company of homes. So they want them to go to their sister facilities or their facilities that perhaps the company that's closing a home is affiliated with. So if, you know, an elderly person doesn't have a power of attorney for their loved one to make these choices for them, and, you know, they themselves are older and confused and aren't really sure what to do, you can see a scenario where they could get taken advantage of.
Did you say one report in your stories that one family member actually had to call the police over this?
Yes, that's right. This happened at Oak Pavilion in Walnut Hills about a week ago. A family member wanted his uncle to go to a nursing home that he chose for him where his daughter-in-law worked so she could keep an eye on him. And apparently the nursing home was trying to get the uncle to go to a facility that was affiliated with their company. So when he arrived to pick him up, there was some dispute over where he should go. And the gentleman I spoke to had power of attorney over his uncle. So he called the police and just said, you know, look, I'm getting a lot of static here and, you know, a lot of arguing. And the poor uncle was in the middle. And once the police determined that this gentleman had power of attorney, they let the uncle go with him to his new home, which it's unusual that a police get called to a nursing home. For sure. But you can only imagine what would have happened if he did not have power of attorney over his uncle.
Well, yeah, you mentioned how important that is. Is it the fact that some family members aren't even being consulted about these moves based on what Pro Seniors has told you?
Pro Seniors says they've gotten calls from family members in a panic saying, where has my father gone? I don't know where he is. Nobody called to tell me where. And they literally do not know where their parents have been taken to. Which is terrible.
Yeah.
But again, you know, if they don't have a power of attorney over their resident and over their family member, and the elderly resident sort of gets talked into, well, wouldn't you like to go here? And here's, you know, I even heard stories about offering people private rooms, offering them all kinds of things to try and persuade them to go to a particular nursing home over another one.
You talked about the economic pressures that are feeding into this. What advice, if any, is Pro Seniors giving families, not only families who are being affected by this now, but who have loved ones in nursing homes as these economic pressures continue?
I would say the number one thing is really to stay involved in your family member's life and be present and be on site and be talking to the staff, talking to your family members so that you know what's going on right away. And then to know your rights. I mean, anybody who lives in a nursing home has a right to be treated with dignity and respect. And they have a right. They're supposed to have 90 days to be able to choose another home if one is closing, and have a right that all of their items are packed up and brought with them. In many cases, that didn't happen. Family members called me and said that his wallet's missing, his walker's missing. It was really just heartbreaking. So those would be the big ones.
Yeah. Well, Paula, thank you for your reporting on this. I want to talk to Tana now about the important reporting that you did this week. This Cradle Cincinnati report comes out every year. I know you've been following it for many years, as yeah. I used to as a reporter myself. What did the report have to say about infant mortality in Hamilton County last year?
So it ticked up a little bit, not a huge amount, but when you kind of look at where it had been going the previous 5 years, it does kind of look like a fairly large jump. So the infant mortality rate for 2022 was 8.7 deaths per 1,000 live births. But then if you look, so that was 89 babies who died before their first birthday in 2022. Mm. But if you look at 2021, it was 66 babies who didn't make it to their first birthday. So not a great, but on the whole, since Cradle Cincinnati started back in about 2012, 2013, still trending down on the whole. So yeah. some good news, I guess.
Right. Every single one of those deaths just, I know, is shattering for families. What is behind the increase in deaths last year? What did Cradle Cincinnati have to say about that?
So the two leading causes are still preterm birth-related deaths, caused by stresses during pregnancy, unexpected pregnancy, smoking. These things all contribute. And of course, implicit bias, which has been something that Cradle Cincinnati has been working on a lot. And then sleep-related deaths. So people co-sleeping and things that go wrong with that.
Yeah, that's been such a problem for so long. People have these images of snuggling with their baby and sleeping with their baby, and Cradle Cincinnati's and trying to tell people it's just not safe.
Right.
What's the message the organization is trying to get out about that, about those sleep-related deaths?
Right. So sleep-related is what they've been pushing for a very long time, the ABCs of safe sleep. Babies sleep best alone, on their backs, in a crib. So I know, you know, if you may think co-sleeping was fine for my mom, it's not today. Don't do it.
Right. Don't risk it. And didn't you hear from Cradle Cincinnati that once they kind of got a sense that these trends were going up in 2022, they tried to really reinforce that message in a big way late last year? What'd they do about that?
Right. So they, for Safe Sleep Month, they really sort of tried to drive home that message, the ABCs of Safe Sleep. And Meredith Shockley-Smith, who's the executive director of Cradle Cincinnati, told me, you know, when we really push these messaging, we do see the numbers come down again. So it's a matter of sort of staying on that messaging. But then with the preterm births also, you know, looking at the reasons that those numbers are so high. And so about not quite five years ago, 2019, Cradle Cincinnati really turned its push unapologetically, they said, on Black women, because Black babies were dying at a much higher rate. And looking at sort of some of the systemic racism, the implicit bias in the healthcare system that was affecting these things and causing these outcomes, you know, people not being treated the same or not having their health concerns treated equally. And, you know, so therefore just not seeking care because, you know, well, it's such a horrible experience and I'm not listened to or I'm treated poorly. Why would I go there? Or just not knowing what's available to them.
Right. So will that emphasis continue based on the results that they continue to see?
Yes, exactly. And in fact, the Queens Village option, which is one of the things that Cradle Cincinnati has created to really provide community around the support, just had a big conference here in Cincinnati where now there's Queens Village chapters around the country. And so they came to town and talked about, you know, how we can make better outcomes.
Yeah, the importance of wrapping people with that support when they're going through what can be a beautiful but also very stressful time. So I understand you reported, too, there's going to be a new strategic plan coming soon from Cradle Cincinnati. Tell us about that.
Right. I don't know a whole lot about what's going to be in it. I assume that it will focus largely on Black maternal health and outcomes. That is going to be released on June 28th, as far as we know. And so they had been, I was just looking back at some of my reporting and, you know, some of the goals that they had set that would expire, I guess, if you will, in 2023, you know, zero deaths and things like that. So I think it's kind of a resetting of priorities and a resetting of expectations. Mm-hmm.
Important to do that for every organization,
right,
every so often, that's for sure. Well, I have been talking with WCPO9 iTeam reporter Paula Christian and WVXU senior editor and reporter Tana Weingartner. Thank you both so much for your time today. I hope you both can get some R&R this Memorial Day weekend.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Lucy.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Asiya Johnson. Technical director is Derek Smith. If you miss our program live, you can subscribe to Cincinnati Edition wherever you get your podcasts. And if you're looking for a previous episode, our archives are on our website, wvxu.org. I'm Lucy May. Thanks so much for listening. Hope you all have a happy Memorial Day weekend.